Thank you. My question can be answered by any of the speakers, both morning and now. First of all, I wanted to find out if there is any similarity between what we know as the traditional broadcast and the webcasting, especially in as far as the traditional broadcasts find their way into the internet, if there is any similarity. And then also, when the presentations were made on the webcasting, at least they talk about efforts to discourage piracy. But nobody has said anything about private copy, although in principle, private copy may not be illegitimate, but in the long run, private copying as well as piracy have some negative effect on the sale of legitimate copyright works. So whoever can address my questions, I'll be very grateful. Thank you.
Maybe I can address the first of those questions. I mean, our view is that on the face of it, webcasting and broadcasting may appear very similar. But when you lift the lid on webcasting and look at the flexibility of the technology and you look at the range of issues that the technology covers and can deliver, you find that we feel that physical broadcasting and webcasting are two entirely different entities. If you just look at the way that the content is delivered to a consumer via television or radio, you would never expect there to be a buffer or a cache of data held inside a television or radio. In every instance of webcasting, you will find a buffer or a cache of the broadcast in the local device. And as we heard this morning, that cache is entirely dynamic in nature. It's entirely, the size of that is entirely determined by the receiving client and in many cases how the user configures that client. So you have immediately with a webcast the capabilities, whether intentional or not, to have a copy of that programming sat on a local machine that can be accessed in many, many different ways, which is never the case with a TV or a radio broadcast. And I think that comes a lot of our, to address a lot of our concerns in the second issue, which is, without wanting to get into a debate on private copying, what is very clear is that there is a massive scope for copying of digital media of any type. And we shouldn't be led into an assumption that because data is streamed, it is any different to being downloaded. The only differences in streaming data and providing purely real-time webcasting, i.e. webcasting that doesn't persistently leave something on a server or on a client machine, is down to the individual implementation of that webcasting system.
Спасибо. Так, еще один вопрос. Вы хотели добавить, да?
The questioner has left open the possibility to hear from some of the morning speakers too. I guess what I would like to clarify is that the decision of whether the stream is recorded or not is not made by the user. It is made by the webcaster. All of the major webcasting technologies have the ability to control copying on the user side. It's true that the PC has some decision as to how much information it needs to store temporarily, but it is the webcaster that decides that the storage is only temporary. The webcaster can set the technology to make sure that all of the information after it is played is deleted permanently from the computer. So from that perspective, there are still very clear differences between downloading and streaming that will persist into the future. And as I mentioned also, any circumvention of that copy protection technology has been deemed to be unlawful, at least under the rights in the United States that were enacted pursuant to the WPPT.
Спасибо за такое дополнение. Так, еще один был вопрос, там не правительственная организация. Чили, извините. Чили, пожалуйста.
Gracias, señor presidente. Quisiera hacer una pregunta técnica en el sentido de si puede ser en el futuro determinado el lugar donde se pide la, el acceso a un sitio web o se pide on demand una materia protegida. O independientemente de si se puede determinar el lugar específico donde ha sido hecha la solicitud, ¿puede el sitio web poner límites a la frontera donde, territorial donde puede ser efectivamente recepcionado?
¿Quién? Por favor, señor
At the moment, to the best of my knowledge, and I've done extensive research on this topic for both our webcasting activities and also our paid-for internet service activities, there is no reliable way of identifying where a consumer is geographically located on the internet. There are a number of services and a number of companies who will offer to resolve from the what's called the IP address, the internet IP address, offered to try and resolve the location of a consumer. But IP address on its own is certainly not robust enough. As an example, all of Vivendi Universal's employees outside of North America have an IP address that appears on the internet as if they're coming from France, regardless of whether they're, like me, located in London, Italy, Germany, Spain, wherever. Everybody in North America appears as if they're coming from North America. So the IP address is not robust on its own. There are other techniques that can be used. You could try to determine from the language used in a browser or the configuration of an operating system. But again, to date, none of these things have proved to be robust. The only system that we've been able to use at the moment is to try and resolve people by a credit card billing address when they've gone to purchase something online. I hate to say there'll never be anything in the future, because technology is one of those areas where never say never, I think, but certainly I don't think for the foreseeable future, my opinion is that we can have a robust geographic resolution service that doesn't rely on some other non-web-based tertiary service to provide that information.
Так, пожалуйста, Египет, последний вопрос и еще один вопрос неправительственной организации. На этом, к сожалению, у нас очень мало времени. Пожалуйста. Уже нет.
شكرا الحقيقة يعني أريد أن أوجه سؤالا للإخوة المتحدثين حول العلاقة بين التقدم العلمي والتكنولوجي في مجال الويب كاستنج وحماية حقوق الإنسان على المستوى الوطني والمستوى العالمي. لأن ما يقال إن التقدم التكنولوجي في مجال الويب كاستنج بيؤدي إلى تأكيد حرية الرأي والتعبير، ولكن أيضا يؤدي على الجانب المقابل إلى صعوبة وضع معايير للممارسات الضارة بثقافات الشعوب وأخلاقيات الشعوب. كيف يمكن أن نتعامل مع مواقع بتبث ويب كاستنج تدعو إلى الحرب مثلا، أو تدعو إلى الكراهية العنصرية، أو تدعو إلى كراهية الأجانب، أو تدعو إلى التمييز بين شعب وشعب أو ثقافة وثقافة، أو تدعو إلى المساس بالثقافات التقليدية للشعوب، مثلما نتكلم عن حقوق الويب كاسترز فلا بد أيضا أن نتكلم عن القيود الأخلاقية والقانونية التي تحافظ على حقوق الثقافات وعلى حقوق الإنسان من ممارسات الويب كاسترز. هل لديكم تصور حول كيف يمكن أن يتعامل العلم مع مثل هذا الموضوع؟ شكرا.
Кто хотел бы из докладчика? Очень коротко ответить, хотя вопрос очень настолько обширен, что коротко, наверное, просто невозможно на него ответить. Ну, готов кто-нибудь? Скорее. Пожалуйста.
I think there are two points. There have been some technologies developed that will filter out particular types of content. So a user, for example, can decide that they do not want to see, let's say, things that they would find offensive, and can enter these types of information into this filter, and thereby decide that they do not want access to such types of content. That is one thing that is currently done, and there is kind of a rating system that a lot of webcasters and internet websites already use to define what kinds of content are available on through their site. The other aspect of this is really legal and not technological, which is that when people say that the internet is not subject to regulation, I disagree, because the internet is subject to every type of regulation. It is subject to commercial regulation with respect to any commercial transactions. It is subject to regulations concerning fraud or obscenity or inciting types of speech. So every type of regulation that exists for the physical world relates also and is imposed upon the internet. And so from that perspective, the regulatory issues really deal more with issues of spectrum allocation, not so much with respect to whether there are various criminal acts or acts that deserve civil sanction being created in the process of webcasting content itself.
Спасибо. Так, пожалуйста, очень коротко вопрос и ответ.
Speaking on behalf of music managers, I'm surprised that the gentleman from Universal Music Group finds webcasting so completely different and undefinable using existing language. And so I'm interested to know his view on why a webcast of a live performance is not the communication to the public of such a performance, how the temporary residence in the buffer of a computer of protected material is not an ephemeral fixation, how allowing the public to access a webcast that is fixated is not firstly the fixation of a protected work, and then later the making available of that work at a time and place chosen by the user. Thank you.
I think my point to that is that it may well be any one or all of those things. The difficulty is that under the term webcasting, it can be any or all of those things or a myriad of other things. I think the overall difficulty here is what you may feel is an adequate definition of webcasting may not be what is implemented by certain people or the view that certain webcasters have. So I don't disagree that it can be any of those things, and the consequences associated with that may well be. But the great difficulty that we see at the moment is that it could also be a great deal of more concerning It may be better. There just is a lot of ambiguity around what actually is a webcast, what is being held where, what access does a consumer have, what territorial, if any, constraints are put around that.
Спасибо. Я еще раз хотел бы поблагодарить всех докладчиков за весьма интересные и полезные для всех нас информацию, доклады, сообщения. В рамках нашей программы основные темы завершены, но здесь немножко еще хотел бы попросить вашего буквально внимания, хотя и мы выбились из графика, но есть предложение заслушать небольшие сообщения по теме нашего комитета. Сообщения, с которыми хотели бы выступить перед нами представители фирмы Fox Group of News Corporation из Калифорнии, господин Рональд Билл и Андре Сетос. Да, речь идет вот о бродкастинг. Пожалуйста, Broadcast Flight. Докладчиков мы основных благодарим. И, пожалуйста.
Thank you for the opportunity to present our concept called the broadcast flag. We appreciate the time that's been given us, especially given the lateness of the morning session. I also want to say that I'm here representing the North American Broadcasters Association. I'm a vice president of that organization, and that organization represents broadcasters from Canada, Mexico, and the United States. We believe the and when I say we now, I mean broadcasters of NABBA believe that the broadcast flag is of paramount importance given developments in the broadband internet. Digital television, digital terrestrial television, does represent a tremendous number of opportunities for broadcasters as well as consumers who receive those broadcasts. But as with all very flexible technologies, there are great risks as well. We believe that the broadcast flag offers a simple solution to stop the unauthorized retransmission of our broadcast signals. We believe the broadcast flag will be given regulatory approvals in the United States very soon, the fall, we expect, and then we will seek broader global recognition of the concept. So digital television, digital terrestrial television especially, does provide for higher resolution images than we are used to in analog, crystal clear pictures, CD quality audio, not available in analog. And this is why it's so exciting. But today, digital compression technologies available to consumers using desktop PCs allow unencrypted digital terrestrial television signals to be copied and redistributed while still preserving the picture and sound quality. This is going on today, and given the discussions that have been occurring this morning, it's clear that what we're trying to avoid here is consumer webcasting that is not authorized. And this will only get worse as continuing developments in digital devices, compression technologies, and the capacity and speed of the broadband internet will only make this phenomenon worse.
What are the consequences of this phenomenon to over-the-air broadcasting model? If over-the-air broadcasters are unable to control the consumer webcasting or this unauthorized redistribution, then it is likely that the over-the-air economic model will become unattractive as a delivery platform for high-value content. This content will naturally migrate to protected pay TV platforms like satellite and cable delivery. When that happens, over-the-air viewership will inevitably decline. And in in when that occurs, citizens who currently receive their television broadcasts via over-the-air broadcasting will lose universal access to unique, high-quality, and otherwise important content, for example, political information about election campaigns. In this process, over-the-air broadcasters will lose millions of viewers and billions of dollars of revenue, making it harder for them to sustain themselves. Producers of high-value content, in turn, will lose one of their most important distribution platforms.
Now, recent examples of this unauthorized redistribution are iCrave TV. This was an unauthorized retransmission of U.S. and Canadian signals on the Internet in the year 2000. And it was finally shut down with various court actions. Then the Napster effect, as we call it in the United States. Quote, on Monday I watched the latest episode of ER just a few days after it was broadcast in the U.S., which I had downloaded from the Internet. Almost all the programs had been broadcast less than a day earlier in the U.S., many months before viewers in the U.K. and Europe will see them. And this was from BBC News Online on May 7th. And also, to just put in perspective the tremendous benefits of the Internet and how that can backfire on orderly markets. 10 years ago, a very short time ago, a typical length song took 8 hours to download, and of course now it takes seconds. And with this flexibility that is the speed and convenience that's being allowed for the unauthorized redistribution just gets worse, worse, and worse.
So what is it that the broadcasters are looking for to control this problem that we've identified? What we are looking for is the ability to technologically control the redistribution of broadcast signals, both when they are initially broadcast over the air and when they are retransmitted by cable and satellite systems. And in so doing, we want to avoid unnecessary restrictions on access to viewers. Such restrictions could arise if the model were adopted of encryption at the source. Those issues would involve selecting an encryption system, designing it robustly to so that it can be upgraded, and delivering decryption devices to consumers. So we're seeking a technology that avoids those problems associated with access to viewers. We're also seeking a system that avoids unnecessary restrictions on viewers' own ability to enjoy over-the-air broadcast content themselves. So the proposal we are making in the U.S. Allows time shift recording for personal use and allows redistribution within a consumer's home network.
So the solutions that we have looked at in the United States and we have rejected are first encrypting the digital terrestrial signal at the source. The Internet has come upon us over the last decade, and digital terrestrial television in several administrations, including the United States, was also put in motion at that time. And so hindsight is always 20/20. And in the United States, and I would assume in countries like Korea, Japan, the UK, and Australia, at the very least, where digital terrestrial television is already in place, as well as other North American countries like Canada and Mexico, many, many consumers have already purchased digital television sets. Encrypting at the source would not respect the legacy purchases of these consumers, and that's a very serious concern for us as broadcasters, because we want as many people as possible to watch our programming. Also, encrypting DTV at the source would require an unprecedented cooperation between broadcasters, manufacturers of products, and consumers, which have traditionally had open access to broadcasting. And this was a daunting, this would be a daunting task that would be out of the experience base of all those companies. Also, require every device that handles unencrypted digital television content to identify it and prevent its redistribution. Now, this point is possibly best explained in the obverse, which is the proposal of the broadcast flag is that when content is received, or when the broadcaster has turned on the flag, again, this is the right of the broadcaster to do or not to do, the product would then identify the fact that protection is required. And from that point on, the mandate of the broadcast flag would end, and commercial applications would be relied upon to protect the content from that point on, using traditional cryptographic approaches for protected content. And so rather than have a system whereby an open statement of this is protected content be respected by every single device that a consumer might acquire, would put governments in a place of having to regulate every single piece of equipment, which we thought was unbearably difficult and impractical. So what this technique, this protocol takes into account is that the content of the unencrypted digital terrestrial TV signal would be identified by the DTV receiver and protected from that point on using proprietary and commercial technologies. Therefore, downstream products like recorders or displays that wish to receive that unencrypted DTV broadcast would need to opt into the technologies that were used to protect. Now, what's very important here is that the flag is more or less like a single-purpose DRM with a single rule. There's no intrusion into traditional home activities of time shifting, making permanent copies of that time-shifted recording, and home network exchange. There would be no effect on legacy devices, as I said before, and we would rely on commercial marketplace solutions for the protection of the content downstream of the DTV receiver, and not have government regulation be intruding into the design and manufacture of every type of product that would touch digital television.
So why is it that WIPO should care about the broadcast flag proposal and the problem it addresses? We've heard a number of people tell us that this is not a copyright matter, it's a technology matter. We respectfully disagree with that. We believe that the protection of content and signal rights from illegal redistribution of those signals is a core function of WIPO. Digital terrestrial television is the future of broadcasting, and the WIPO's treaty protection must address the special risks inherent in this form of broadcasting, the future of the broadcast industry. A broadcaster treaty should not only guarantee DTV signal protection as a legal matter, it should also guarantee that broadcasters will have the technological means available to them to enforce their rights. Thus, WIPO should provide the framework by which all countries can guarantee the integrity of their digital terrestrial television over-the-air signals in a harmonized manner. We're happy to take questions if people can stand to delay lunch a bit longer.